Buenos días, buenas tardes, buenas noches. Otro episodio of the Fry Show. Conmigo el gringolo.com, LBJ Fry.
Hello, hello, hello. Another episode, but this time in English. My guest is Brian Reckworth, the Latitude co-founder and author of Viva the Entrepreneur. He's also the co-founder and former CEO of Viva Real, a leading prop tech business in Brazil. A big one. He merged the company with Zap, owned by Grupo Globo, and became the chairman of Grupo Zap. Brian raised $74 million in venture capital funding for Viva Real and now invests in the most promising tech companies in Brazil and Latin America as an angel investor. This podcast is about his book he just launched, Viva the Entrepreneur, Founding, Scaling, and Raising Venture Capital in Latin America. I believe, and maybe I'm going a little bit too far here with the analogy, or it's too complex, but the best way to describe this book is a quarter-inch drill hole. I'm referring to the reference by Theodore Levitt, the German-American economist and professor at Harvard, if you're familiar with Jobs to be Done and that whole line of thinking. It's that the average drill, and we're talking about a drill you use to put holes in the wall in your house or any more in a construction company, etc. The average drill is only used for 15 minutes in its lifetime. So that's to say, if you buy this drill, you're getting 15 minutes of value. That's not the best use of money or time. You don't need a drill, you need a hole. You're contracting the drill to put a hole in the wall. What you actually need, the job to be done, is a hole. The same concept applies here. It applies directly to his book. The drill in this case is a stack of business books that you read once or don't even read at all, which is a waste of money and time, the latter of which you will never get back. But with Viva the Entrepreneur, the quarter inch hole is how to build a company in Latin America. You are buying the book for the correct job to be done, which is how the hell do I launch a startup in Latin America because no one is talking about this. That's the reason Brian wrote this book. The book's amazing. The information is applicable immediately. Every chapter has at least one oh shit moment. You know, those moments, perfectly packaged bites of information that force you to highlight and share. I believe probably my two co-founders are probably pretty tired of the WhatsApp group, because while I was reading the book, it was basically just highlight, screenshot, share, highlight, screenshot, share. I mean, I've got more than 200 highlights in this book. I loved it. It was just a pleasure to read. Some of the highlights in the podcast are the five behaviors of a cohesive team model, incredible, growth hacking your first investor, a special story that didn't make it into the book, You Have to Trust Me, a beautiful, beautiful story, especially for me who lives in Colombia and has a Colombian wife and family. The difference between being vulnerable and conviction, which is awesome. I'd never made the connection before or understood it. And a whole lot more. A little blurb from the book. Viva the Entrepreneur shares the lessons Brian learned while building his company. He shows how to manage your own psychology and your operation, be it working with co-founders, building a culture, or managing a board of directors. Brian also reveals the secrets of scaling a business and best practices for venture capital in Latin America. That chapter, those chapters alone about venture capital, worth the book right there, and it's amazing. The real potential of this book is what makes it so exceptional. And I'm not sure how many will grasp this concept at this moment, but this podcast receives messages all the time, thanks to the stories from my guest. Why? Because those stories are not available. They're available here in this podcast because these guests are willing to share their stories with me and I'm able to share them with you. Brian is where he is thanks to reading a case study on Mercado Libre in a coffee shop. That was enough to spark his brain, the inception, to plant the idea which would eventually lead to Viva Real. So now, just take one moment. Imagine what the future will be if millions of potential entrepreneurs in Latin America have access to this book. We're going to have to wait 4 or 5 years down the road to see the impact of this book. I know it's going to be amazing in this moment, But the real impact of this book is going to be in 4 or 5 years when people start naming this book as the reason they took certain decisions in their startups. So Brian, everyone listening, Brian, thank you for taking the time to write this book. Thanks for the time. And also, please make sure to check out his podcast and get your copy right now of Biba the Entrepreneur. It's available in Amazon. I believe it's at a discounted price. I'm not sure for how long. Once again, love the book. It's amazing. Please get a copy. See, if this is the first time you're listening to the podcast, hello, hello. I'm sorry. Yes, it is in English. When Brian's book comes out in Spanish, hopefully he will grace us with his presence once more and we'll do the podcast in Spanish. I wanted to do the book justice because it is in English. So I wanted to give the benefit to Brian and then do another one in Spanish if he's ready for it. If you're a fan of this program, you're listening to it, please subscribe to the email. You can find it in thefriarshow.com. You can also subscribe to Little Inceptions, small audios that I put together and send 1 minute or 2 minute to WhatsApp daily. You can find it at thefriarshow.com/quotables. And of course, if you want to get access to all the books, the podcast, the people we mentioned in this podcast, you can get them all at thefriarshow.com. Just look for Brian and there's his LinkedIn, his Twitter, and access to his book in Amazon. Thank you so much for listening. You can always make more money, not more time. Thank you, thank you, thank you. With that being said, episode 144. The episode is called How Did I Get on This Fucking Lion? With the co-founder of Latitude and the author of Biba the Entrepreneur, the incredible, awesome, amazing Brian Reckwith. Hey, first of all, you can always make more money, not more time. Thanks for your time, Brian. It's awesome. What a pleasure to have your knowledge and learn from this time. So first, thanks to you. Thanks to your family for the conversation. Really, really appreciate it.
Hey, pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me on.
And I loved your book, man. Fucking amazing.
Love it. I'm glad you
really
love
do.
It, man.
Like, and there's no bullshit. I actually enjoyed the process of reading it. And the information.
That's like, makes me really happy because that's why I wrote it, right? Like, I'm not trying to be like a bestseller author that, makes a bunch of money from a book. My audience is too small and narrow, startups in Latin America, for it to be a big bestseller. But I wrote it for entrepreneurs and I wrote it for people that are passionate about our ecosystem. And so I'm really happy to hear that it resonated with you.
Yeah. And I know, and that's one thing. I'm really curious to see the reception of the people because, you know, I just started a company with two friends back in October. And so the conflicts were, the pyramid that we're going to talk about, the pyramid structure, amazing. The trust and then conflict. But so I'm curious to see how people resonate with the book who are not building a company, but are interested in the startup world, if it's going to have the same impact on them. And if it'll be a cult classic here, like the hard thing about hard things, but in the Latin world.
Hey, I don't know. I mean, that's my inspiration on the book is a lot of the hard thing about hard things and venture deals are the two kind of things, the two books that really impacted me as an entrepreneur. So I wanted to kind of tropicalize a lot of, my experiences. And, I was just talking with Linda Rottenberg from Endeavor today, and she talks a lot about the importance of we were chatting this morning, and she, Endeavor is an organization that I've been a part of for a while. And she talked about the importance of storytelling, right? And how, like, when I started my business, Marcos Galperin was the kind of person I looked up to because he was building Mercado Libre. And I'm like, I remember being in Bogota and, in an internet cafe, and I downloaded this PDF case study of that. And, those are things that, like, changed the course of, of history for me, because it allowed me to think a little bit bigger. And so hopefully, that inspires some more founders.
Before we even get into the book, tell me about, I'm really interested in process and specifics. When did you decide to write the book? Was it a culmination in front of, I have to write it? Was it now's the time? How did you write? How was the structure? Did you give yourself a deadline? How often did you write? When did you write the whole entire process as it was structured?
Yeah, it was an interesting process. I mean, I was thinking about it today as if I'm going to write another book, and the answer is no, probably, because it's a long process, and it was hard to do. But the thought process that went into the book, I actually had a realization relatively early on that I wanted to like pass on some of the experience. So I actually had a Dropbox document that I started like years ago, like, I don't know, 8, 10 years ago, where I would just literally drop in anecdotes and moments and thoughts. And so I had this document. It got to like 15 pages long, you know, of just like, you know, one line sentences that I wanted to remember. And because the reality is, as you're building your business and you're on the entrepreneurial journey, like there's so many little anecdotes that happen. It's like when I think about my kids, I just wish I could remember every single thing that they said, because it's, you know, like there's all these moments that, you know, they escape you at some point. And so I think I kind of knew I wanted to write a book. Also, you know, the realization when I was like, okay, now is the time to write a book, was as I was wrapping up my deal and selling the company, I was already on to like the thought process of what's next for me, because I need some kind of purpose and I need some kind of like North Star and direction. And so given that I transitioned from CEO and I became chairman, I was less in the operations. That's when I was like, okay, I have a little more time. And so, and I've got, you know, a desire to do something and put energy into something. So I think that a couple of years ago, I kind of hatched the idea of like, okay, I think I'm going to do this.
But let me go back into some details real quick.
Sure.
Why, how long ago was the Dropbox, and why not Evernote? Why not another phone?
Yeah, why not Evernote?
And now why not by hand? Did someone tell you, hey, and where were you at in your company? Like, was it a recommendation? Hey, you should really jot down your ideas because you don't want to miss this adventure. I mean, it seems pretty long thought process oriented to start writing those ideas to capture what you might lose after you sell the company. We're sitting here.
Yeah. And it's like, I didn't start the company to sell it. But I did have a real acute awareness of something. And, you know, I'm a lot of it is I'm a storyteller. I like to think of myself as a storyteller and desire to be kind of an educator. I mean, my journey started in Colombia, and I was an educator in the beginning. I was teaching English, right? And that was my first job, my only like real kind of, you know, job before Viva Real, and led into my kind of start of my entrepreneurial journey. And so, you know, the one acute awareness I had was even in the earliest days of Viva Real, I remember my co-founder in Brazil. He had this like mini office where it was like the size of like a pantry where he operated out. And I remember I was like, Diego, film that office, like take a picture of it. And actually there's an article on TechCrunch where a pretty famous writer, Sarah Lacey, went to Brazil, and we invited her over and wanted to like show around São Paulo, talk about the startup scene. This is in 2011. Or no, 2009, sorry. And she took a picture of that office, you know? And we, you know, fast forward several years ago, we had this big, you know, 11-story office building in São Paulo. And we actually recreated a replica of the office that he had when he was building his business, when he was building the business in São Paulo. And so we wanted to tell the story about it. And we wanted people that joined and saw this, like, you know, big company with 500 employees that, like, hey, we start off in this tiny little place, and you know, we can't forget about our roots, you know? And so I guess that like that same line of thinking, I had I was cognizant of wanting to remember the journey and you know, and why I did it in like, you know, Dropbox and Word. I don't know. I just started writing one day of like everything that I remembered, and it was like, you know, a couple of years into the journey. And then I was like, just go visit that every couple months.
So just from your own nature, it's inspired by this little closet. Man, I better start writing this shit down.
Yeah, it's kind of like, I was like, this is going to, like, it was so absurd, like the absurdity of what we were building, sleeping in the, you know, the living room of my co-founder's apartment. It was just stupid, right? Like, this is, like, I remember sleeping in the you know, the living room, like, of his apartment, my wife and I, like, this is ridiculous. And, like, it was in this neighborhood where there was all this construction going on. Midnight, jackhammers in the street, you know, just like, da, 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 da. And I'm just like, what the fuck am I doing? You know, but, and then I would just try, you have to be lighthearted about it, because as an entrepreneur.
No, you don't have to. I don't know how you got there. I have some questions about that. So let's go on. Okay, let's say you have to do it in order to succeed.
You choose to do it because it's so absurd, right?
Okay. It's too surreal. Like, it's so far beyond what normal reality is that you can't compare it to anything. So the only choice is just to keep going on?
Yeah, keep going on and like also just kind of take like a be amused by how ridiculous the situation is, right? Like, there's so many times as an entrepreneur where I was just like, oh, sweet. You know, like our lightning kind of struck our building and fried our network. And now we have no internet access and we're an internet company. That's just absurd. That's stupid. And that happens all the time as an entrepreneur. Not that incident, but like stuff like that, you know? So I just wanted to document that for my own kind of remembering and being able to look back and, tell my own war stories and just remind myself that it's a journey. You know, it's not about the end. It's about enjoying the ride.
This is going to be a weird analogy or my attempt to connect two things in as one, because you just said war stories and thinking about in this description, the jackhammer at night, is that I just read a book. It's called The Things We Carry, because my dad was in Vietnam and I wanted to better understand. And I finally started talking to him about it. And he said, read this book. And they discuss, and then part of the people listening, I'm in no way comparing Vietnam to startups. I'm just comparing. They discuss how trying to talk about Vietnam and the experience in the jungle and being there is impossible because it was so surreal. It's like
totally
so far away from reality that what happens, you can't get upset and you can't get sad because you go through so many emotions because there's nothing to compare it to. So what you're living is new. So the only thing you can do is just carry on. So it seems similar maybe in the human state and consciousness that when you're so far outside of reality, there is no other option because you can't compare it to what was because there was no what was. This is the new. What you're doing is the reality that will then be for other people.
Yeah, and it's a lonely journey and it's a hard journey. I mean, obviously it's, it's all relative, right? Like, you know, I'm lucky that I got to be a founder. I'm so lucky that I got to like build a company and, you know, and work with amazing people. And so like super grateful and gratitude all the way. But yeah, I mean, it's a hard, lonely journey. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I wrote the book is that I hope when people read it, like the same feeling I had when I read The Hard Thing About Hard Things, like I literally read that book and it was during an extremely like emotional moment in the company where I'm like, I remember the exact moment when, you know, I finished the book. It was 2014. I had won the Entrepreneur of the Year award, yet I felt like everything was falling apart. And so like, I'm like, this is so ironic. Like I'm, you know, everything is so great on the outside, but inside I'm like, dude, it's kind of like there's a great article, that's in Inc. magazine. It's called The Psychological Price of Entrepreneurship. And there's an image of a guy riding a lion and everyone's like, wow, that guy's, you're so brave. And the guy that's riding the lion, he's like, how the fuck did I get up on this lion?
That's it, right? It's just, how did I get here? Let me connect that to the first chapter of your book, the best day of your life and the worst in the same day. This is just for me, my curiosity. Did Ben Horowitz ever write you back? Because you said you wrote him a letter. Did he write you back?
He did, man. He did. And it was a short, brief, but encouraging message. And it was probably what I needed at that moment. So he responded and he was like, keep fighting through the struggle. And it was great. I mean, you know, he didn't have to take the time. He probably got a lot of fanfare and, I appreciate it. I appreciate the fact that he took the time.
Did he leave a quote from Tupac or Biggie at the bottom?
Yeah, I don't remember if he, I might've thrown a hip hop reference in my message, just cause I grew up listening to hip hop too. I don't recall. I think he was pretty all about business.
There's an interesting part in there that I loved about the vulnerability. And you talk, I think it's Brene Brown, right? You reference in there
in
a TED talk.
Yep.
I just got done speaking. And if he's listening, I love him. And he's one of my favorite entrepreneurs is Miguel McAllister. And we just had a Medicare. And he talks about you have to be a puto toro. Like you, like if your wife asks you, how are things going? Great. Awesome. Amazing. Even though you're dying on the inside, you got to say shit is going amazing because you might go in this downward spiral. But you share the opposite, which is you got to say, hey, man, shit's not good right now, but we're going to get through it. How do you balance who to tell, what to tell to get that help so you don't show, I mean, I don't want to say showing weakness is bad. It's just you need to give the perception of what you imagine your company will be so other people believe in your company. But at the same time, you need people to help you out. How do you know that balance of who to share and when to wear the shield?
Yeah, I get that. And Miguel is, you know, I've got to know him a little bit recently and we're, you know, co-investors in a bunch of deals. And I was, you know, the trendy internet, you know, I was on Clubhouse with him, like I think earlier this week. And so, I mean, listen, you don't go out and just campaign your miseries, right? Like that's not what I'm recommending. But I think that what you want to do, the balance is find people you trust. Part of it is like with your team also, like you need to, like one thing that I did ironically is that I was like all about opening my team up to vulnerabilities and like, hey, I need help with this. Because basically, you know, in my case, I built a really good team. People were super smart. They all went to the best schools and they were used to being the smartest person. And they were really smart. And the you know, it didn't gel perfectly in the beginning. And we had to work on like a team dynamic. And you've got to be able to, you know, ask for help. If you can't ask for help to somebody and you can't show weakness, you know, that's something that, you know, you're not going to get any help. And so it's a balance. You know, you as the CEO founder, the founder, you know, you carry a lot of burden. But what's surprising is if you can share the burden with your team and you can, with your investors, you can also, like, if you've built amazing trust with your investors, you don't want to blow smoke up their ass at the board meeting and say everything is amazing if it's not, because it's your business and it's going to be obvious that it's, if it's not going great. You know, so I think that you got to find the right balance there. I would say the best vulnerability and the best way you can kind of build your community is find other entrepreneurs that maybe don't even have skin in the game. They know what you're going through. And, you know, in my case, I called it the Breakfast Club. You know, I had a handful of other entrepreneurs that, you know, I could call up Thomas, Sarogi, you know, Kimball, and, you know, we would get together and, you know, we would talk about, you know, what's going on with us. And like, you know, we coach each other through different situations. And so that is really important and really critical to find, you know, your community and find your breakfast club.
You know, Miguel was saying when they were getting Rocket was coming and they needed certain money and their board wanted to sell and they didn't agree with the philosophy and they needed enough money to buy them out to make the next step. It's like, they can't go and say, hey man, this huge company is going to come and kill us. We're shitting in our pants, but we have this vision of the future. So one is you're actually shitting in your pants, but the other one is your vision is so strong that there's no other option. How do you, I mean, I'm sorry to keep going on this. It's just,
yeah.
I don't know when you say I need help, where you think people are going to see it as a weakness and where people say, hey, I can help you. That's awesome because I believe in what you're doing. Where's that balance? Where does it come from? Just the relationships you build along the way?
Yeah, in terms of like your investor stuff, I mean, the best investors, you know, they back you and they, you know, and you know, they have conviction in what you're doing. So, you know, there was times like during the journey where like, I remember having a conversation with Nico Sakazi from, you know, Kazek, and I was like, hey, you know, there's a potential like offer that we could potentially sell the company. Someone's interested. And he was like, man, you know, supportive of me. It's like, if that's what you want to do, you know, then you go for it. There's a threat of a big, you know, big company coming in. But the reality is, so you want to find people that back you and believe in you, right? Number one. And a lot of investors in the region are less experienced. And so they might, you know, they're worried about something. They're worried about someone else coming in. So first of all, find people that are deep in your corner and that are going to back you through the hard stuff. The best way to identify how good of an investor is not when things are going well. It's when shit's hitting the fan. And that's when the true colors of investors come out and you can see who's kind of, you know, who's in your corner. And so I was able to see that, and I was fortunate, you know, that my investors were really supportive of us, and that, you know, I didn't really have any major conflicts. Obviously some difference of opinion sometimes, but yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's an easy answer of like how you get the, you know, and how you're able to, you know, it is a constant, like you need to get people to believe in you. Right. And so, you know, if you don't believe in yourself, the investors will know that. And so I think that the number one message to send is if you don't believe in it, other people won't believe in it either. And if you believe in it with everything you've got, it's hard to bet against an entrepreneur.
Okay. Yeah. I guess you have to have the conviction and then the vulnerability. Well, if they see the conviction coming from, hey, I have to do this, but I need help to do it, then it kind of gives you permission to ask for help, because the vision is what's leading the asking for help. It's not a depression or some sort of other.
And also, like, you're not, what you're asking help for is your investors aren't going to solve a bunch of your problems for you, right? So like, you can't expect that as a founder. Like, investors aren't going to come in and, you know, and solve problems. But like, I remember, you know, I shared this in the book, you know, we didn't have like a finance person, right? And here I was showing up, and I had these like two top tier investors in my first board meeting at Monashiz's office. And I'm like, hey, I spent the whole night like working on the deck, and, you know, I had this like really, really weak presentation on the finances because I didn't even know how to work Excel properly. And I was like super embarrassed about that. And when I showed up to the board meeting, like the board deck looked like shit. It looked like a third grader did it. And so I was like, you know what? I'm not going to bullshit you guys. I'm not very good at this, and I need some help with the finance piece. Listen, the board was like, hey, let's get someone in there, you know? And what, you know, this is the former CFO of Mercado Libre on my board, right? So that, and then we found someone, you know, I ended up getting, you know, I think Monashiz helped me find Sasha, which was, you know, she's now, an investor at Atomico in London. She's got a, you know, amazing investor career now, but she like got our board materials together, and they're like, listen, Brian, we didn't invest in you because you're some kind of Excel guru, right? And if I showed up the board meeting and like made excuses or like, you know, I just own that shit. And then I was like, cool, let's, now that we know where we are, let's go solve that problem.
See, maybe that's where it's at too. Maybe it's don't show weakness where people think you're strong, because maybe that's an internal problem, but no problem to show weakness where you actually have weakness. You know, like, yeah, if someone expects you to be the leader and you're like, hey, I'm not being a good leader, they're like, well, step your game up then, man. Quit bitching. But if you're like, yeah, hey, man, the tech side's weak, I need help, they're like, yeah, we know that's not his strength. No problem. Here's the help. So maybe.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, own your shit that you're good at, right? And like, you know, I mean, I know what I'm good at, and I think I'm one of the best there is in the area, in those areas. And my team also, you know, is amazing at certain things. But there's areas where like any business has holes, any business, you know, needs support, and you gotta be realistic with those areas, and then you fill the gaps.
When Nico became one of your investors, this, you know, there's a book called The High Growth Handbook, I believe it is. And one of the chapters talks about when a new CEO came in, I can't remember what she said, hey, this is how I work. This is how I like to operate. This is my life. This is how it functions. Just so you understand when you communicate with me exactly who you're communicating with. Did you guys sit down? He said, hey, man, I'm Nico. This is what I've done. This is who I am. This is the conversation I like to have. Was there kind of a ground rules for how things work? Or was it just like meeting a new friend, say, hey, let's go out, have a beer and let's talk. But I believe in your company. I believe in you.
Much more the latter. It was a good investor is always asking, how can I help? Like, how can I help? And so there's a misconception by a lot of entrepreneurs in Latin America that like, you report to the board. If you're the CEO of the company, you report to the board, and eventually you raise venture capital. You have a structured board, but you know, your investors should, you know, they're there to create value for you too, right? And they're there to like differentiate. And it's, you know, it's good investors are selling themselves too. And then when they're in the company, they want to be your favorite investor, right? And so they want to be the person you go to and ask the heart, you know, ask for the help and when you need it. And so, the ground rules were not really defined. It was more of just like, you know, and also it was early on in their investing career. So like maybe they operate differently now, but I don't think so. I think that they're just there to help. You know, they have their principles. All of the good investors do. And you know, and then but ultimately all the investors just want to help the company succeed. And so, you know, they're there to try to make that happen.
That's really interesting you say that, Brian, because I had watched some video, I don't know, not too long ago from a YC startup school that they have on there. And I can't remember who was giving the talk, but he was talking about normally in these groups when people get together and they start, you know, networking, blah, blah, whatever they want to put the name on it. And people share an idea. The first thing someone wants to do is shit on it. No, how big is the market? That's not right. And he said he realized it's so easy to do that, but it's harder to jump on the vision and say, ooh, what if you did this? What if you did that? And it seems like what you mentioned in the book, a good investor versus a bad one. A bad one's going to ask you too many questions and a good one is going to ask you, how can I help?
Well, I would say that it's before you invest, there's a lot of questions, right? Because, you know, you've got to prove that you're, you know, it also depends on the stage of the company, right? I mean, if you have an early stage investor where you've got a pre-seed or a seed company, and they're asking about 10-year financial projections, run for the hills. The reality is, once an investor becomes an investor, the good investors are, you know, are asking how they can help, right? And not to say they won't challenge you, right? I mean, I had a lot of debates with my investors about different things. And, you know, ultimately, sometimes I would change the course of what I was doing, you know, because I got good feedback or, you know, there was, you know, good questions that were being asked and made me think about things differently. But I think that early stage investing, you know, is different than like a late stage investor where, yeah, it's much more about the metrics. It's about the growth. It's about, you know, those are all important for early stage, but you know, it's less important when you haven't found product market fit. Talking about, you know, the discounted cash flow is a silly conversation because, you know, you're just trying to get the business to go. And so, yeah, I think that's my advice to entrepreneurs is, you know, work with those investors that kind of understand how to about value. And that's why institutional investors, you know, that maybe, or investors that don't have experience in the asset class, you know, what you might find from like a Colombian family that, you know, owns a bunch of real estate, but has never invested in an early stage startup. Maybe they're attracted to the idea of investing in an early stage startup, but it can really, you know, hinder the company because they won't have the right mindset of like, you know, what's important at an early stage company.
This is a perfect segue into, I know that we jumped right in. So for the people listening, we didn't even name of your company, name of the book, name of the company you sold and merged real quick.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, just to go back here, you know, Brian Reckworth, Viva Real, we merged it with Zap, became Grupo Zap. I was the CEO. I became the chairman of the combined company. And then we exited the business. The transaction closed in November of 2020. Yeah, now I'm building my next thing,
which is called Latitude, right?
That's right. Latitude. Yeah.
We'll get to that in the end. So you can give the plug for the podcast and everything like there. And the reason I'm asking is I'm trying to remember in the book, I think you're in the lobby, it's pouring out rain. And you tell your wife's name is Andrea.
Yep.
And you tell Andrea, you have to trust me, right? Yeah. How the fuck? I mean, I have a wife and two girls, and sometimes I don't know how to explain what I'm doing, why I'm doing this. And you're right. You just got to trust me. What was your conviction? And then give us a little bit of like a fast story for time, how you got here, what was the company, how it started, and then what happened in that moment and why you were able to tell her, you got to trust me.
Yeah. So there's a lot to unpack there. Where should I start?
Let's unpack it. Unpack it from the beginning. You drove a car. I think you met her first, then drove a car to Costa Rica.
Okay.
Then to
Colombia. I'll give you the quick story. As a foreigner, you know, as an American living in Colombia, you can appreciate this. I'm from California. I drove from California to Costa Rica, bought a one-way ticket to Colombia. You know, my wife, Andrea, we met in San Diego, and she likes to say that she imported me to Colombia. So I arrived to Colombia, did a handful of entrepreneurial things. My plan was to stay a few months. You know, a few months turned into 6.5 years, and I did all kinds of entrepreneurial stuff to pay the bills. So I'm more of an entrepreneur out of necessity, wanting to kind of sustain my travels. taught English and, you know, and I built websites, did translation services, eventually had a terrible experience finding property in Colombia, decided, you know, came across a Mercado Libre case study from Stanford, read this case study and thought, why isn't there a Mercado Libre of real estate? Decided to build, you know, that. Quickly realized that Latin America is enormous and I can't be across Latin America. So decided to build the Amazon of real estate. Then realized that Brazil is just an enormous market. Ended up going AAB, all about Brazil. And then moved to Sao Paulo, Brazil with my wife. No kids at that time. And we duked it out in Brazil for a couple of years, bootstrapped, and finally scraped together a little bit of capital from some friends, family, and then a few angel investors that would ultimately help change the trajectory of our business.
And so where was the name of the company is Vivo Real, right?
Yep. Vivo Real.
So, so you're in the lobby of the apartment where you guys are both sleeping, where we started the entire podcast, right?
Yep. Yep. I'm in a one bedroom. My co-founder, Diego, my wife and I are, you know, spending the month in as I'm getting this company going with Diego. And yeah, it was one of those torrential rains in Sao Paulo, aguaceros como Colombia, when it just like rains and the streets are like flooding. And, you know, I remember we were getting ready to go outside and, you know, she actually asked to, you know, talk in the lobby and she just burst into tears. She just, and she's like a very tough woman. She's like I
most
to say
Colombia
that she's,
women.
she's like a you know, an iron fist wrapped in a velvet glove, basically. And so when,
like,
you know,
wife.
when she broke down, you know, it was a hard moment because I was just like, you know, I had self-doubt too about what we were doing, but I kind of just got, you know, dug deep and, you know, I kind of looked at her and I basically said, hey, listen, you got to trust me. We're going to make this shit work. I promise you, we're going to make it happen. And, you know, she kind of wiped the tears away and then she said, okay. And we went after it. And that was very shortly after that, we got our first kind of capital infusion, you know, by a guy in Australia of all places that, you know,
Simon?
Flew out. Yeah. Simon Baker. And, you know, like he came out and, you know, we hosted a little event, which, we invited all of our potential customers in the market. We marketed Simon, who had built a $1 billion company in Australia in the same sector. We hosted this event. We charged real estate agents to like come hear him speak. And then we took the proceeds in that and turned around and paid him for his trip to come consult with us. And then, you know, shortly after we signed up 50 customers and he wired us some money and we lived to tell the story.
Why the hell wasn't that in the book?
I don't know. I saved it for the fry, man.
That's amazing. But let me ask you a question, but I need deeper. And maybe I don't know if you can answer it because sometimes there are no answers. Was it your ego and in the best sense saying to your wife, it's going to work? Because I mean, what else are you going to say? We're up Schitt's Creek and I don't know if it's going to work. You know, you can't really tell. You don't want to tell it to your wife. Was it you really believed in it? Or is it you as competitive? No, we're going to get this done, whatever it takes, because that's who I am. Do you know where it came from? The vision, competitiveness,
yeah.
Or being a husband?
I mean, all of the above, right?
Like, yeah, but which one? I mean, give me the 80-20.
No, I mean, I think that I do think that I have a deep conviction of like that I'm capable of figuring things out. And, you know, I think that, you know, I did believe in myself. But yeah, I mean, part of it like was a little scared, right? Like, I don't want to go back to California and like with my tail between my legs and be like, yeah, I tried to do it. It didn't work, you know? So there's a little of that in there too. Maybe a chip on my shoulder that like definitely helped me kind of fight through the difficulties. So I think it's a combination of, you know, conviction and belief in that it was possible. And, you know, but it wasn't, you know, the self-doubt is there, right? Like, I think every entrepreneur, you know, the whole, like, I remember when I learned about the framework around like the imposter syndrome and I'm like, oh, there's a thing to describe this thing that I'm feeling. Okay. Like that's handy. That makes sense. And I can relate to that. You know, and I felt like that for many years as I was building the company. You know, you eventually get more confidence and, you know, you are able to push back that voice that tells you, you know what, you didn't go to the best school. You haven't achieved enough yet to be able to do it. And eventually you overcome that and, you know, you just level up as a person. And so I definitely battle with all of those things. I think everybody does. And anyone that says they don't, I think they're lying.
That's an amazing, you know, I'm really visual thinking. I always like, you know, trying to put things in a better way to understand what's already out there. And it makes sense is that to level up, you're actually stepping on the pushback to get higher. It's like, oh, you didn't go to the right school. Who gives a shit? Another step to go higher. It's like everything that's trying to go against you, you finally use as an actual stepping stone to become a better person. Like the leverage comes to pushing things back or pushing things down to go higher.
Absolutely.
And let's talk about the panic attack, just because I think that's an important thing that a lot of people don't like to talk about. I've had them before. I guess you never hear in the startup world about health or about mental health. We talk about numerous, we talk about venture capital, but a lot of people don't like to talk about how difficult it is mentally and how difficult it is emotionally sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I feel like, you know, in my case, I grew up in like a super supportive home. Like I have two parents that are, I mean, literally my parents, my mom was a psychotherapist. My dad was also a therapist early on in his career, became an entrepreneur. And so like I have like the best listeners in the world that are like super supportive of me. So, and I grew up with a lot of like good core kind of like communication skills. And so it's a testament to how hard it really is, the journey, because
okay,
if I have such a support system and I push myself over the edge at one point because, you know, I didn't listen to the signals of like, hey, you need to rest a little bit. You need to take it easy. You know, then I think that, you know, that can happen to any entrepreneur, and the mental health is real. Like it's super stressful, you know, running a company. And, you know, there's a great person on the topic that I advise that you bring on the podcast. If you're interested in the subject, you know, his name is Michael Freeman, Dr. Michael Freeman. And he is, you know, I met him because I had a panic attack. And I can go into that if you want, I don't mind talking about it. You know, it was a combination of just like stress, traveling around the world, not sleeping well, not eating well, not taking care of myself. And, you know, and then also just feeling this burden of all these people that had believed in me and a particularly difficult time in the company. And ultimately just like it culminated in an event where, you know, a panic attack, for those that have never had one before, you know, it's your brain is like basically telling you like that you're dying or like, you know, it's a really crazy, you know, thing that happens that it physically manifests. And, you know, I ended up having that incident. It was, you know, crippling for me. As I'm in Sao Paulo, I'm flying. I fly back. I check myself out of the hospital, and you know, my co-founder picks me up. You know, who happened to be in Sao Paulo. My friend Thomas Florax, who we founded Vibral together, the other co-founder. And you know, we go to the airport, and I'm on the plane at 30,000 feet in the air. And I'm literally, you know, reading this article that I already referenced about the lion, you know, the entrepreneur and the lion. I revisit that article, and there's a quote in there from Dr. Freeman. And I Google Dr. Freeman, and I'm like, who is this guy? This is like insightful, you know, stuff. And it turns out he lives 45 minutes from my house. And so I end up contacting him because I'm like, I got to make an adjustment in my lifestyle because this is really intense and I can't put myself through this. You know, it's not fair to, you know, me or anyone else. And so I ended up, reaching out to him, had a conversation with him. I had kind of sorted what was going on with me at the time. And I think I kind of worked through it. I still ended up meeting him. And it turns out he was launching a mental health accelerator. He was actually had this idea that he wants to empower entrepreneurs to kind of, you know, support them in their mental health, which is really important as an entrepreneur. And he now is a partner in Latitude as a mentor advisor, and he leads a session. He's worked with, you know, hundreds of entrepreneurs already in our last two cohorts and advised them on this topic. And so we're, you know, that's one of the initiatives is, you know, we help with product market fit. We help with, you know, all these other, you know, components, fundraising, recruiting, but the mental health piece, if you don't have that, you know, well adjusted, like it's going to be a hard journey, and it happens sooner or later. And so you need to get a handle on it.
I like the way you phrase certain things. You have a nice way of specific words that have power. Like you said, it wasn't fair to me or anybody else. Like, you didn't make it about yourself. You made it about you and the community who was around you on your team. So that's one, just a compliment. It's nice that you just didn't make it about you. And the second one is, I like that you said it's a testament to how difficult a startup is. It wasn't, oh yeah, I was sucking, it was my fault. No, it's, man, this is a tough world and these things happen. It's a consequence of trying to do something like I was trying to do. So do you think even if you're on top of the mental health, you have Dr. Freeman right from the bat, that you're still going to have the risk of going through these things, or that you can pretty much block them out if you start with that as like a habit, like you would to run?
Yeah, I think that you're much more likely to have a handle on that if you address it early on, right? If you go into it and prepare yourself mentally and, you know, really have an awareness about these issues, you're going to be more prepared and you're much more, you know, likely. There's some research that he's done, which I'm not a doctor and I haven't, you know, participated in any of these studies, but there is some interesting correlations between mental health and entrepreneurs. And so, you know, how that affects you as an entrepreneur and how you can kind of make the most of your, you know, who you are as a person.
The co-founder relationship. The CEO, his job is to not run out of money, right? Is to make sure the business does not run out of money.
There's a handful of other jobs, but that's probably the number one job.
Why isn't that the CFO? Why isn't that the job of Hernan? Why don't you talk? Why isn't a CFO? I mean, can you have a CFO / CEO or a CFO?
If you're running a startup, chances are you don't have a CFO in the beginning that, you know, but in the beginning of a company, the number, you know, and I really focus a lot on early stage. So like, if you ask the question for a, you know, a scale up company that is doing $30 million in revenue a year, that's probably not the number one job of a CEO, but of an early stage startup that is in its first 2 years of existence, your number one job is to not run out of money. Because if you run out of money, you're dead. So that's the context of the statement. And as you scale, you know, probably your role as a CEO will evolve. You know, all of a sudden it becomes less about, you know, you're going to run out of money because you've already proven you have product market fit, you have customers buying it, hopefully you have investors interested, or you have your own cash that you can survive on. All of a sudden, then it becomes about the vision and the culture. Those are, you know, and the products. Those all of a sudden become, you know, they take, running out of money becomes a backseat because it's less of an issue at that point. But the statement I made in the book was more around early stage startups.
You said, we talk about a CTO, like eventually the CTO might branch off and have to take over another role like leadership, but versus the CEO is always a generalist. Is the CEO always a generalist, or is the CEO should have one talent that's above all others, or the CEO is the maximum generalist that can move between any type of field without problem?
The CEO in a company is the generalist, and everyone else has more focused areas of concentration. So if it's tech, you know, it's CTO, you're focused on the tech. You know, if it's product, if it's marketing, you know, the operations. So yeah, the only true generalist in an organization is the CEO.
Okay, awesome. One of my favorite parts in the book was the triangle or the pyramid that goes from trust, conflict, commitment, accountability, results. And then you add gratitude. Where does gratitude? Can you just tell the people about me? Just go through them because they're awesome.
Yeah, the framework is, it's a framework that, you know, was helpful in us building a better team dynamic. You know, when we started, we had a lot of very, very smart people, but we weren't working as a team initially. And this was a framework that one of a great person called Lynn Waldera, she brought this into our team. And it's a framework that, you know, if you think of it as a triangle, at the base of the pyramid, you need to have trust. Trust is fundamental to everything. And when you have trust, that allows you for you to have conflict. And when I say conflict, you know, when you're building a business, there's going to be different opinions about how to do things. There's going to be teams trying to work together. You know, if you don't have trust, you can't have the best ideas, you know, that are kind of challenging each other. And the best companies, you know, you're challenging the premise. You're working, you know, to make things better. And that results in conflict sometimes. You know, a lot of my co-founders and I, we had a lot of conflict over the years, never got out of control, you know, rarely where it exploded. But, you know, we had enough trust where we could debate and challenge. And, Thomas would often say, like, man, I think that you're missing the point here, and here's why. And, you know, that was positive because it moved us forward. And so that's the second layer of the pyramid. The third layer is, once you've had those debates and you've got best ideas and you figure out how to move forward to the next thing, then you've got some commitment. All good teams have commitment. You need to say, I'm committing to this. We're going to do this. This is, you know, the next steps we're taking now that we've had this debate and we know what we're doing next. The fourth thing on the you know, rung on the pyramid is you've got to have accountability, right? The best organizations, you know, they run in a way where it's everyone's responsible for delivering, and you've got to have transparency about what you're working on. And that's the fourth part. And then at the top of the pyramid, the results of all of that is if you can have trust, that breeds, you know, the ability to have conflict and best ideas win scenario. You commit to making sure that you follow through on those best ideas. You hold yourself accountable for following through on those ideas. Then you've got results, and that's where you're a high performance organization.
And the gratitude that's missing?
Gratitude is like the circle around all of that.
Okay.
I don't know. I just made that up, but gratitude
like the
Da Vinci, is
the circle around the perfect man, the Vitruvius perfect. Man is the gratitude.
Yep, that's it.
There's a part, I don't know where it comes into two chapters, but the si señor mentality.
Sure.
That you could just get in Latin America, for me, you can just get rid of that whole block that's called conflict. And you just get mediocrity, because no one will ever tell you that they don't agree with your idea, especially if you have any position. If you have a longer name tag, good luck getting someone to challenge your idea. I mean, even I was speaking to the president of Bancolombia, who I admire a lot, and he was saying one of his hardest jobs or hardest things is being alone, because no one tells him, Juan, I don't agree with you. And the people he really values in his life are the people who say, I don't agree with you, so he can challenge his own ideas. But in Latin America, that conflict doesn't exist. How do you manage that? Is it the same in Brazil? I know it is in Colombia, but I'm not sure about Brazil. And how do you deal with it?
Yeah, I think maybe to a lesser degree. And of course, like, this is, you know, this is more commonplace, but I think there are some great organizations that are, you know, have figured that out. It's not like every company, you know, in Colombia or Latin America has that issue. But it is
90%.
more prominent maybe. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, I remember sitting, you know, another rainy day, in Thomas's apartment in the 85, if you know where that is. I think it was right around that area. And we were in his living room, and we decided to hash out, like, the, you know, what we called it at the time, core values, which I refer to now as virtues. And one of the things that, you know, really, like, stuck out to me is that, you know, we wanted something that was kind of shocking. You know, we didn't know why we wanted it, but now, like, when I think about it, it made sense. And because we wanted these values to be something that would, like, make people ask why, kind of, and, like, be a little bit of shock therapy. So one of the core values we defined, or virtues, as I would say now, was, don't do shit you think is stupid. We literally wrote that down, and we, you know, like, we would, when we would onboard, you know, people into our team, we would actually describe that as one of the things that we, that was a core value for us. And it was kind of a shocking thing to say, right? Like, you know, you hear these other, like, you know, lofty kind of, like, you know, values that you hear, you know, like, oh, you know, we value teamwork, and we value, you know,
honesty
and, like, you know, and transparency. And here we are saying, you know what? You're welcome to the team. Don't do shit you think is stupid. Because too many times where, you know, listen, I don't, so many things I don't know. I'm making this shit up as a founder. I'm a first-time CEO. If someone tells me that it's a good idea when it's clearly not, I get pissed, because that's a disservice to me. It's a disservice to the company. It's a disservice to the person is not doing any favors. So I did a pitch the other day, and someone on my team reached out to me, and I totally switched up the pitch right before, you know, I changed everything right before we did the pitch. And, you know, Tommy on my team sends me a message. He's like, yeah, I didn't really like the way you did it this time. It wasn't very good. If he would have came at me and said, Brian, that's really cool, I really like the new pitch, but he didn't think about it, I would have the mediocre pitch that I had before, and I wouldn't be refining it. So yeah, it's absolutely. But again, you have to have trust. There's a challenge in Latin America of the que dirán, right? Like, you know, what are they going to say? And so people oftentimes kind of fearful of that. And you've got to just embed this into your culture from day one. And the only way that you can do that is by providing example and kind of showing and that you value and you listen to people and encouraging them that they need to challenge the status quo. And, you know, did we do it perfectly? Probably not. But, you know, we at least defined that, you know, don't do things you think are stupid. And that hopefully helped us over the years when people saw that we were making dumb decisions.
The second rule about the be with entrepreneurs, don't do stupid shit. The first rule about be with entrepreneur, don't do stupid shit.
Yeah. Yeah. Don't do things you think are stupid. It's not about don't do stupid shit, because actually it's not that, because don't do stupid shit is okay. It's okay to make mistakes, right? So we actually would encourage people to make mistakes. If you tell people not to do stupid things, they'll be fearful and they'll be afraid that they're going to do something that's wrong. And that's the exact opposite culture that you want. You want people to take risks. You want, you know, take risks, make mistakes, but learn from them. And so that's something that we also drilled home. So the don't do things you think are stupid is different than doing things that are stupid.
Yeah. Gotcha. Let's go. That's perfect to go ahead into the value versus virtues. I think that you mentioned Jack Krupronsky.
Yep.
And I love the difference that I think you mentioned, that values versus virtues. Virtues are actionable, values are not.
Yeah, virtues are lived behaviors, right? It's great to have all of these, you know, aspirational, you know, honesty, integrity. You know, those were also on Enron's wall, right? And so they clearly didn't live by those behaviors.
Don't do stupid stuff.
And by the way, for those that don't know Enron, you know, in Latin America, is a big company that was a big, you know, house of cards. And, you know, they had these great values that were on the wall in the lobby. And yet they were doing very, you know, shady things that ultimately, you know, they paid for later. And so my point is, it's all about behaviors and actions. And and that's why virtues captures that in a better essence.
And you still, I mean, and I think mistakes are virtue builders. How do you build when you're building this company? Is it, I mean, would you recommend, I think you say in the book, build them right off the bat, but it seems like it's hard to build what you are until you understand who you are. So you need to give yourself permission to actually build them in real time until finally like, yeah, this is who we are. These are the mistakes we made. These are the mistakes other people have made. We're not going to make these mistakes. And these are our virtues.
There's a great book on this very subject that I think dives into this even better. And it's, oh God, what is the book name? Hold on one second. What You Do Is Who You Are. That's the best culture book that I've ever read on, business culture. And so that book exemplifies a lot of like the philosophies on culture. And so in terms of like defining your cultural values, like, when we started out, we were just like, you know, I went to the company that I'd formerly worked at as a 19-year-old at an internet startup. And I was like, well, the company culture was pretty cool there. Like, we should just make that our company culture. But, you know, it wasn't authentic and true to me. And so we ended up, having various iterations of what we kind of believed in. And it wasn't until we built Viva Rao that we actually had like a company culture defined and the virtues clear, because we'd spent 4 or 5 years building different, you know, projects and companies. And we started understanding what it takes to be successful, and we started understanding what doesn't work. And so, it's hard to build your kind of your company virtues if you've never built a company before. You're still figuring out what you value, right?
Two things I really want to cover before the very end is, one is the vanilla. Like, I think that's just the most amazing advice, is like, don't sell vanilla ice cream, strawberry ice cream, and chocolate ice cream. Sell vanilla. That's the best way to do it. Make everything simple.
Yeah. So one of my advisors, Simon Baker, who I previously mentioned, he came down and he met with us. We actually originally hired him to be an advisor and a consultant for us. He ended up becoming an investor, which is the best kind of, I don't, I don't advise hiring consultants in your startup. At this point, we ended up bringing him on because he had built this big company in a similar space, really the same space in Australia. And so early on, when he ended up investing and getting kind of deeper into the business, you know, it was at an early stage in the business. Just for those listeners to understand our business model, we're a real estate marketplace classified website. There's, you know, kind of a chicken and egg problem where you need a lot of inventory, a lot of properties, and there's a lot of people searching for properties. And then there's a lot of value created when you have those connections that are being made from people trying to find real estate and people trying to sell or rent real estate. And so in the early days, we didn't have the inventory. And so there was really no reason why people should visit our website because, you know, there was no properties there. And it was no real easy way to get people to list their properties on our website because no one was searching, right? And so one of the strategies that we had, before I'll get into the vanilla story, was we ended up actually building a robot that went in and scraped our potential customers' websites. We needed the inventory to drive consumers. We populated our website with this inventory. And then all of a sudden overnight, we had a bunch of traction and people, basically visiting our website and searching for properties. That was a very good growth hack in the beginning to get the marketplace dynamics going. Now, when you look at the monetization, we started charging for that. We converted those people into paying customers. Our competitors had this very, very complex pricing scheme where, you know, list 10 properties, it costs this. List 20 properties, it costs this. 50, 100. And ultimately, what Simon Baker told me one day, he was like, Brian, you know, we didn't know better. We copied the competitors and just made it cheaper, right? Which is a losing strategy because if you do the exact same thing as your competitor and you just charge less money, you're going to lose every time. So what we ended up doing was we ended up changing the model. And instead of having these different pricing tiers with these different, you know, numbers of properties, we just said, it's all you can eat, you know, all you can list. And we went to our customers and we said, we don't have pricing tiers. One, we want all of your inventory because that's useful for our consumers that are searching. And two, just one thing to buy. There's no strawberry. There's no chocolate. It's just vanilla, vanilla, vanilla. And this reduced the complexity for our sales teams dramatically because when you give someone 15 options, they're, you know, they have, you know, the kind of the decision making, paralysis because there's these different, you know, different things to choose from. And in our case, it was like, hey, it's all your listings. It's fixed price. There's, you know, not a lot of things to choose from. It was cheaper than our competitors, but we also got more inventory, which then kicked off this network effect of having more inventory and driving more consumers. So the vanilla, vanilla, vanilla strategy was super important to keep things simple. And in the early days, you know, entrepreneurs like to kind of chase the bright and shiny lights and they complicate a lot of things. And this was a lesson in simplicity.
It seems really, really strange, this whole system. It just seems so much energy to get money to do what you're doing, which is great and making the country better. It just seems so strange.
I do think the dance is crazy, and it is a game. And founders that are listening to this, you know, if you don't understand the game, you're not gonna be at the table. You're gonna be on the menu, you know. And so I think that's something that I try to like peel back the layers in my book of like psychology of the investor and what motivates them and how they think. And, you know, I wish there was a better system. I wish there was a better system where, you know, whereby it was like, okay, this person deserves this money because of this. It, you know, ultimately it ends up getting to some of the founders that, you know, deserve it, but it's the founders that know how to play the game better, basically. I'm an example of someone that, you know, they took a bet on me when, you know, maybe it didn't make sense. So I think that the bottom line is just how the venture game works is, you know, it's very, you know, if you don't have a strategy in how you fundraise and you don't understand one, the psychology of how investors think, two, you know, how to run a very efficient process, three, how to like position your business for, so it's enticing for investors. Four, like what kind of things investors look at. Five, understanding what investors like certain aspects, like that, all that stuff is just like, if you're a first time entrepreneur, you just don't know about that. And you have to, you know, trial by fire. And so what I'm trying to do with this book is to, you know, peel back the layers and make it in simple terms so that people can understand it.
Three books you'd recommend.
Ben Horowitz, is both of his books. I think the guy's incredible. And we talked about him and inspiration for me. The last book, I'm going to recommend a book that, has nothing to do with entrepreneurship. And I'm going to see if it's up here on my library. It's Shantaram.
Oh, that book's amazing.
I recommend this book mainly because, like, sometimes you need to take your mind off the ones and zeros and you need to, like, let it fly and let your mind relax. I'm giving this advice despite being pretty bad at it. So, I'm aware of, like, the fact that I don't always do this. That book is a pretty cool book, and it's a book that allows you to disconnect a little bit. And
it's amazing.
You need that as a founder.
It's one of those books that burn the image, like the images I can remember from the book are still there. I don't forget the book. I remember the context. I remember the motorcycle. I remember the friend, and I read it a long time ago. The book's wonderful. Good one. Yeah. Okay.
And then the two other books were The Hard Thing About Hard Things. And, you know, I would throw in Venture Deals there too as well. So
if you could send a message to everyone in Latin America on WhatsApp, what message would you send? One like tweet to everybody in Latin America when they get their bzz, bzz, and they look at their phones. What message would you send?
Well, I think, I would probably like the words of encouragement of just like, you know, and this is more directed at founders in the region, is like, there is infinite opportunity. And so instead, you know, where a lot of people see challenges or friction or difficulty, I would encourage everybody to take the inverted of that and consider that it's just a world of opportunity. And so, I would love to see more entrepreneurs going after big, ambitious ideas to transform their region and, you know, make a global impact.
So what would the message be?
I don't know. I mean, if it's like in a tweet, you know, not to be kind of super cheesy here, but it's like, you know, journey, like, you know, don't stop believing or something, you know,
it's good.
That's what it takes, right? Like, it's just a hard, lonely journey. You're not alone. And you know, don't stop believing.
So I would add to that. And if we're in the where we're at now, it's more memes instead of messages or more images. So I'd put you consoling someone who's crying in a lobby in Brazil with an aguacero, says, don't stop believing. Don't stop believing.
Yeah. That's, you gotta have the optimism, you know, there's no other way. And you gotta believe that you can, you know, adapt and overcome and, you know, superar las expectativas, como dicen en español.
Without a doubt. Hey, Brian, hey, you can always make more money, not more time. Please let the people know the name of your book, the name of where they can find you on Twitter, LinkedIn, and the name of the podcast and the name of your company so they can find you, please.
Sure. So yeah, again, it's Brian Reckworth. Find me on Twitter at just Brian Reckworth is the handle. You know, I'm on LinkedIn as well. You know, you can go to Amazon and buy the book. It's out. It will be out when people listen to this. So yes, it's, we're, you know, if you're publishing next week, it'll be ready to go. So the book is going to be live on Amazon. It's Viva the Entrepreneur. And, would love your feedback. Feel free to send any, you know, comments, you know, thoughts, you know, and you know, I wrote it for those entrepreneurs that are kind of in the struggle and trying to build the next thing. And then the last thing I'll say is, if there's, you know, any entrepreneurs that are, you know, building their, you know, next company, at Latitude, we're looking for super ambitious founders that want to transform sectors and, you know, that are in early days of either ideation or, you know, MVP and, you know, want to build the next kind of generation of iconic companies. You know, apply to our program at latitude.com. So Latitude in Espanol, Latitude. Really look forward to, you know, trying to help the next generation build the incredible companies.
Hello, hello, hello. Thank you so much for listening. If you're still here, you're amazing. Hello to everyone listening in English. I appreciate your time, your patience. I hope you enjoyed the podcast, that you already bought the book, that you stopped the podcast while listening to it and just went to Amazon and bought the book, Be With Entrepreneur, Founding, Scaling, and Raising Venture Capital in Latin America. Please take a moment, look for Brian Reckworth in LinkedIn or in Twitter. Send him a message about your opinion about the podcast, what you thought about his book, if it had impact, what had an impact, and why. It would be greatly appreciated. And once again, thank you so much for your time and have a beautiful day. Until next episode. Ciao, ciao, ciao.